Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, what is the city of Visalia doing to get a handle on its homeless population? Ezra David Romero reports on a plan to clean up a historic park near downtown and bring services to those in need. Later, state government reporter Katie Orr looks at whether the security housing units in California's prisons are actually working when it comes to reducing prison violence. And we wrap up our series on California's Delta Inside and Out with a look at the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. We'll also take a trip to a new exhibit at Fresno's Arte Americas celebrating Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, and we'll talk with country music superstar Vince Gill about his new album called Bakersfield and his tour this week through the San Joaquin Valley. That's all coming up on Valley Edition, right after this news update.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. California is getting a little more time to address prison overcrowding. A federal three-judge panel Monday gave the state an additional month to comply with its order to release or transfer thousands of inmates to reduce overcrowding. The new deadline is at the end of February. The court wants to allow more time for the state to negotiate with the plaintiff's attorneys to come up with a long-term plan to ease overcrowding. Attorney Don Spector represents some of the inmates involved in the case. At a legislative hearing on the state of California prisons, he emphasized how crowded prisons have become.
There are about 50% more prisoners in the prisons than they were designed to hold. Some prisons are operating at 170% of their design capacity today.
The Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation says it's pleased with the extension. CDCR has said the state has reduced the prison population by about 25,000 inmates in the past 2 years. The end of California's legislative session has business and labor leaders analyzing how much of their agendas they were able to achieve this year. Max Pringle reports from Sacramento.
Christopher Thornburg with the Los Angeles-based think tank Beacon Economics gives the state points for passing an on-time budget with money to spare. But, he says, changes to the California Environmental Quality Act didn't go far enough.
In my eyes, the CEQA laws in this state have had a terrible impact on the state's ability to construct particularly homes that are affordable for the many people who need them.
Thornburg also says the now dissolved redevelopment agencies need to be replaced to help cities tackle blight. Meanwhile, labor leaders are calling the minimum wage increase to $10 per hour by 2016 a major victory. Steve Smith with the California Labor Federation says housekeepers and nannies also won some gains.
Domestic workers now will get overtime pay like other workers in the state. This is a very important measure of justice.
Smith also applauded the state for extending the Paid Family Leave Act to include people caring for non-immediate family members. At the state capitol, I'm Max Pringle.
The American Civil Liberties Union is asking Immigration and Customs Enforcement to stop arresting people at Kern County courthouses. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin has the details.
The ACLU says that in the past year, immigration agents have arrested people at Kern County courthouses while they were paying fines for tickets, obtaining marriage licenses, and appearing for court hearings. The ACLU asked ICE to investigate and halt this practice in Bakersfield. Michael Coffin is a staff attorney with the ACLU of Southern California.
Our concern is that this seems to be a real practice, a sort of campaign by ICE there to use the courthouses as a location for doing enforcement actions.
The ACLU is also calling on ICE to treat courthouses as a sensitive location where they don't do enforcement actions unless it's absolutely necessary. Schools, hospitals, and places of worship are already categorized this way. In a written statement, ICE said it focuses on immigration enforcement that prioritizes cases involving convicted criminals, other public safety threats, and those who repeatedly violate immigration laws. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Cities up and down the San Joaquin Valley are all struggling to deal with homelessness. The city of Fresno recently made national headlines when it dismantled several downtown homeless encampments. In the Tulare County community of Visalia, city leaders and nonprofit groups are coming together to turn around a part of town known for crime and drugs and to meet the problem of homelessness with kindness.
The city of Visalia is known to many as a small town with the good restaurants on the way to the giant sequoias. Its bustling downtown district is home to a thriving music scene and dozens of shops and entertainment venues. But less than a mile to the north, in one of the city's oldest neighborhoods, Lincoln Oval Park is home to a much different Visalia. It's ground zero for the city's homeless population.
The people in this park are cesspool. They go around and around and around and around. And they never stop. They're insane.
That was Eva, a homeless woman who has called the park next to Highway 63 home for over a year. The century-old public space has dealt with the issues of alcohol, drugs, and homelessness since its beginning, according to Ryan Stillwater.
Yeah, I got a whole stack of old newspaper articles, some old photos, and apparently it's always been a real problem. It was referred to as a sheep pen numerous times, or a trash heap.
He was hired by the Visalia Rescue Mission 2 months ago to reinvent the park. His initiative will launch in the coming months as ovalpark.org.
I got this quote here on my board from 1893 where someone wrote into the paper and said, "The park project is a good one. Lend it a hand. Everybody should be interested in it." So it's always had this kind of this unfinished project mindset.
And that is why the city and organizations like the Visalia Rescue Mission have banded together to curb the issue. A shopping cart ordinance went into effect on October 7th. The ordinance forces anyone with a cart outside of the bounds of a shopping center to turn it over to authorities. Come December, stores will be fined $50 for every cart found on the streets. Under the new law, any homeless person found with a cart will be given a bag for their belongings. They'll also have the option of storing their goods in a trailer at the Visalia Rescue Mission. Since the ordinance went into effect, 30 carts have been confiscated from homeless people, and over 100 carts have been corralled citywide. Jessica Cavelli is the director of development with the mission. She says the condition of Lincoln Oval Park helps spur the community to take action.
Previous to the shopping cart ordinance, it was filled with shopping carts and homeless people, and there were prostitution. The police are always out there monitoring it. And just recently, city council has realized, like, hey, we need to actually enact some stuff.
Visalia Mayor Amy Shucklian says that working with nonprofit organizations will be key to revitalizing the area. She estimates there are about 1,000 homeless people in Visalia.
It's gotten to the point where enough is enough. I mean, the citizens are noticing it creeping more into the downtown and outlying areas. And so we're working on some things that hopefully will help manage the situation.
A 5-tier plan to revitalize the park was submitted to the Visalia City Council earlier this month. The City Council requested more information about the cost of the plan. The improvements include a new playground, security cameras, a walking path circling the park, an amphitheater, and an iron fence on the busiest side of the park. Restrooms, which were once a venue for crime, have now been demolished. Ryan Stillwater's office is in a building at the park that the rescue mission has remodeled into an event center. The mission leases the building from the city for $1 a year. Stillwater's main goal isn't to serve the homeless population, but to slowly change the park's culture by producing events.
My main job is not to act as a case manager. It really is to focus on bringing a positive influence to the park. We considered rebranding it. You know, we just decided we'd rather redeem Oval Park.
But the homeless in the city are skeptical about the impending changes. Eric got out of prison 3 months ago and now calls the park home.
This park changing? You can't change a park. You got to change the people in it.
That's where Ryan Stillwater comes in.
Fortunately, with the restrooms being torn down, with the shopping cart ordinance going into effect, what that's doing ultimately is, at least my hope, that there's less of a convenience to be homeless.
And by doing that, the rescue mission hopes that those living on the streets of Visalia will make their way to the mission for food and what they call restoration.
We don't hope that they're just moved out somewhere else. We hope that they're moved down to the rescue mission, where we have a new community center that opened last September.
Mayor Shucklian says Visalia is at the beginning stages of change, but the rapport they have created with homeless and community organizations is vital. Shucklian says she hopes to see homelessness reduced
to a manageable way so that it doesn't interfere with the quality of life of all Visalians.
She also says the City and Rescue Mission will launch a campaign later this year educating the public on best practices on homelessness. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Supporters say the Bay Delta Conservation Plan is one of the most ambitious habitat restoration programs California has ever attempted. But its proposal to build two tunnels to carry water from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta to Central and Southern California has also become one of the most controversial. If successful, proponents say it could end the state's water wars and help revive endangered species. Opponents say that's a big if. In the final part of our series, California's Delta Inside and Out, Amy Quinton takes an in-depth look at what's at stake.
We're standing on Bolden Island in the Central Delta. Excavators are filling trucks with dirt for a levee improvement project. The Delta has 1,100 miles of levees. Joel Dudas, a senior engineer with the California Department of Water Resources, says subsidence, where the level of land drops, is a constant threat.
We're probably 20, 25 feet below sea level here. You know, we've had, in some places, 30 feet of subsidence. That's what's increasing the stress on these levees.
Levees are also vulnerable to sea level rise, extreme floods, and the big fear, an earthquake.
In my opinion, if we get the wrong earthquake in the wrong place, the amount of money to basically protect the levees against that threat doesn't exist and won't exist. That's my fear, is that we wind up with a delta that's basically good for nothing. It's basically an inland sea.
Salt water would seep in. The pumps that export water would shut down. California's agriculture and 25 million people who depend on the Delta's water would lose it. For how long is unclear. Jeffrey Keitlinger says the Bay Delta Conservation Plan hedges against that scenario. He's with the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, the largest water contractor in the state.
At that point, you know, the luxury of planning and doing something smart will be taken out of our hands, and we'll be in emergency mode. We'll be in post-Katrina mode, and we'll just be bulldozing and not worrying about the environment.
The BDCP seeks to provide both a reliable water supply and improve the environment for 57 species of fish and wildlife. It proposes building two 30-mile-long tunnels, each 40 feet in diameter. They would divert water from the Sacramento River using state-of-the-art fish screens. The estimated price tag for the tunnels and the restoration, $25 billion.
We're opposed to the tunnels because it's bad for the Delta, it's bad for fisheries, it's bad for Delta communities, and it's bad for California ratepayers and taxpayers.
Barbara Barragan-Perea is with the group Restore the Delta. We're at a Walnut Grove coffee shop where the group's Stop the Tunnel signs are everywhere. One of the group's biggest concerns is that the tunnels have a 9,000 cubic foot per second capacity.
The proposed tunnels with the three intakes right now have the capability of taking away almost 70% of the water of what flows through the Sacramento River.
But tunnel proponents say moving the intakes to the Sacramento River will prevent reverse flows at the South Delta pumps that kill fish. Secretary John Laird with the California Department of Natural Resources says there is a difference between capacity and actual operation.
And that is something that's lost because people focus on what the absolute capacity might have been. And in the 40-plus years that the State Water Project has been there, the capacity has always been much greater than what legally or permit-wise can be pumped.
Recently, the footprint of the project shrunk by half, and its proposed path shifted away from some private lands to public, in part to placate Delta residents. Instead, the changes created a new battleground. On Staten Island, Dawid Zaleka with the Nature Conservancy looks over a flooded cornfield. The island is a permanent wildlife refuge the Conservancy manages to protect the threatened sandhill cranes.
15% of the sandhill cranes that come down the Pacific Flyway from Canada, Alaska, come down here to overwinter.
Under the revised BDCP, the tunnels would pass under the island.
There's no question about it. A construction of a tunnel under this island is going to be disruptive.
Zaleka says the sandhill cranes bond to one location every year. State agencies say they could manage construction when the cranes aren't migrating, but Zaleka doubts it.
They're going to need another power line in here. They're going to need a construction pad. There's going to be boring equipment, and we don't know what they're going to pull out of the ground once they start excavating.
The Nature Conservancy believes it could support the BDCP if the project improves all habitat types for all threatened species. Jay Ziegler is policy director at the Nature Conservancy.
How hopeful are you that there's going to be a solution?
It is
the consummate challenge in California's water equation.
The Department of Water Resources says there is no scientific certainty about how to best operate the proposed tunnels to recover fish species and maintain an adequate water supply. California Natural Resources Department Secretary John Laird says ultimately restoring the health of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and making the BDCP a success will require trust.
I think that we are closer to getting something good done than we have been in many years because I think there's a broader acceptance that the status quo is unacceptable.
Draft environmental documents will be available for public comment in November. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
You can see photos, maps of the plan, and hear the entire series online on our website at kvpr.org. This is Valley Edition. California's prison system uses security housing units, or SHUs, as a way to isolate alleged gang members from the general inmate population. But gangs remain a problem in prisons, and the outcry over using solitary confinement for long periods of time is growing. Now some lawmakers are asking whether the SHUs are actually working. Katie Orr reports from Sacramento.
Stephen Sifra spent 4 years locked up in a security housing unit. Isolated from other inmates, alone in his cell for 22 and a half hours a day, he says there wasn't much to do.
I would look at the tower for hours waiting for just to see anything happen, you know, anything. You know, maybe the guy starts eating a sandwich or, you know, opens the door, or any noise, you know, it's like any noise that you hear has meaning.
Sifra says he got lucky. After spitting on a guard, he was sentenced to 4 additional years in prison, not the 25 he could have gotten. And he knew he'd get out of the SHU eventually.
I had hope. I had something to look forward to, something to hope for, something to work towards. And I did. You know, I would exercise every day. I would draw. I would read.
Sifra knew he'd be getting out because he hadn't been sentenced to the SHU because of connections with a gang. He's in the minority. 60% of the 4,000 California inmates currently serving time in the SHU have been validated as gang members by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. That 60% have what's called an indeterminate sentence in the SHU, which means they don't know when they'll be getting out. 23 inmates have been in the state SHUs for more than 25 years.
But I do believe that there is a legitimate reason why we have the security housing units.
Ron Barnes is the acting warden at Pelican Bay State Prison. Barnes has been with CDCR for 3 decades and says he believes prisons have become less violent over time.
Over the years, and I think it's a combination of the newer facilities and the type of control that we have with the newer facilities, I think that, you know, is a contributing factor.
According to CDCR, the number of violent incidents in California prisons has ranged from about 6,000 to 9,000 a year for the past 10 years. Barnes says gang activity remains a big problem at Pelican Bay. Leaders of the 5 major prison gangs are all serving time at the facility. And CDCR officials linked this summer's inmate hunger strike to validated gang members housed in the prison SHU.
Victory! Inside!
Victory!
Outside!
Unity!
Inside.
The 2-month-long strike has spurred inmate advocates to hold rallies to draw attention to the use of the SHU. And it has spurred lawmakers to hold legislative hearings. At a recent Joint Public Safety Committee meeting at the state capitol, Democratic Assemblywoman Nancy Skinner questioned the effectiveness of the SHUs.
We have a lot of people in SHU, but if we're not having any reduction in gang membership, then we have to evaluate whether that's even a useful purpose at all.
UC Irvine criminology professor Karamet Ryder says there are many questions the state must consider. Her research shows the state overuses solitary confinement and that California is one of the only states to allow indeterminate sentences. And Ryder says the state has never done a thorough analysis on whether SHUs make prisons safer.
What disciplinary infractions underlie the SHU confinement? Are prisoners in the SHU because they committed acts of violence within the institution or for some other reason? And do they remain in the SHU because of acts of violence? And then when they're released, do they commit fewer or more acts of violence in the institution?
No matter what the answers, it could be difficult to muster broad public support for any change that might be perceived as letting dangerous criminals off easy. But CDCR officials have taken steps to provide a new path out of the SHU. Inmates can be selected for a step-down program that gradually, over 4 years, reintroduces them into the general population. As of September, more than 500 inmates had been considered for the program, and 150 had been placed in it. At the State Capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with Bakersfield, Californian columnist Lois Henry. She'll talk about government transparency and what is happening in Kern County with a controversial lawsuit from a local community college district. Who's paying for it and how much? That's coming up in just a moment here on FM 89. What happens when a public agency is less than transparent about how it spends taxpayer money, especially involving a controversial lawsuit? Well, when it comes to the Kern Community College District and our next guest, Bakersfield, Californian columnist Lois Henry, eventually you get the truth, but not after a lengthy fight. Lois, welcome to Valley Edition.
Hi, thanks, Joe.
Before we talk about this issue over this lawsuit, let's take a step back and fill our listeners in on exactly how this came about, this legal dispute between Bakersfield College and the California Community College Athletic Association.
Oh, gosh. It's that's a kettle of fish in itself. Okay, Bakersfield College has a booster organization that exists for the football team. It's called the Helmet Club, and the exact membership of the Helmet Club isn't really known, but it's sort of known-ish to be a lot of movers and shakers in the community who, you know, went to BC and they want to support the football team and the football program, and that's all well and good.
Yeah.
But what ended up happening, what they determined was that the Helmet Club was intimately involved in doing a lot of things that ultimately were rule violations. And I can't remember I'm not a sports person, so it took me a long time when I was working this out to understand, like, the level of the associations and how they layer these rules on. But anyway, the community college sporting association has these rules against things like, it's essentially subsidizing college athletes. So you can't, you know, provide them with meals, you can't provide them with housing, you can't provide them with jobs other than what other students might have access to, because there are jobs on campus and whatnot that any student can apply for and receive. Well, what ended up happening was, like, these football kids were all living in the same houses. Then this went on for many years. In these houses, they would actually give the coach their rent, and then the coach would give it to the person who owned the houses, that sort of thing. And it became a real iffy situation. And then these things were brought up, I think, by a whistleblower coach. And so the Bakersfield College ended up looking into it. They hired an outside accounting firm to come and do an audit. The audit clearly states that they have violated these rules in thus and so ways. I mean, there was no, you know, yes or no or whatnot. It was black and white. They violated these rules. And so Bakersfield College came out and said, you know, this has happened. We basically ratted on ourselves. We told the association, et cetera, and so now it's in the association's hands. Well, the association stripped them of their 2012 state football championship because these kids, based on these rule violations, were essentially not eligible to have played in that season. And so, you know, that the news came out, and, of course, all the movers and shakers in Bakersfield got very upset. No, these pencil pushers are just trying to, you know, take our glory away based on these ticky-tacky little rule violations, and we're getting the book thrown at us, and it's completely unfair. Well, it's not. I went on the internet, and I looked up the rules, and the rules are very clearly spelled out, and they very clearly broke them. So I wrote a column saying this is ridiculous, and you guys shouldn't appeal this. Well, the Community College District, the Kern Community College District, which is, you know, oversees Porterville, Bakersfield College, and Coso College up in the desert, they felt differently, largely, I think, because of the political pressure, and they went ahead and went through the appeals process. And there are three appeals and then an arbitration, and we've lost every single step of the way, and so then they decided to sue. which I thought was ludicrous, but, you know, I'd already sort of had my say in my column, and they went ahead and did that. And then we had a reader ask us, how much is that lawsuit costing, and who's paying for it? Because he likewise felt it was an extreme waste of time, effort, and money. And so our editor, we have this little feature every Monday. It's called Ask TBC. The Bakersfield Californian is TBC. So readers write in and they ask us all kinds of things. You know, what's going on the corner of Ash and Ming, and, you know, why can't I get my lights fixed or whatnot? And so this reader wrote in and asked this, and Christine Bedell, who's our editor, who's in charge of that feature, thought, oh, well, that's a good question. I'll just email the community college district and find out, because it's automatically public information. I mean, it's a lawsuit. It's public money. It's not, there is absolutely no reason for anybody to say, oh, well, I have to check out whether that's legal to release. No, it's automatic. It's like salary. You know, it's automatically releasable upon request. So she did that, and then, 2.5 weeks later, finally dug up the answer herself by going through all kinds of different documents and stuff, because what the college district did was they came back to her and said, no, you got to file a public records request. And she was like, well, okay, first of all, that's ridiculous, number one. And number two, it's not a public records request, because I don't know where this information, what record would contain this information.
Yeah, you have to be sort of specific when you're filing a Public Records Act request, generally.
Right. And this is, in my latest column, I said, you know, look, this is what I think disingenuous public agencies do when they're playing around, because they know very well. They might have a record, but, you know, it's not like all of us out here in regular people land know which government record /SOI21-555, right, is the record that contains this particular information. So anyway, so they made her file a public records request. So she did, and in the request she noted, you know, I'm actually asking for information. I don't know the record. So part of the Public Records Act, by the way, also states that if the person requesting the record doesn't know the name of the record, the agency actually has an obligation to help you figure out which record it is you're looking for. Well, not only did they not do that, but they forced her to file this public records request, and then they wait the full 10 days, which just chaps my hide about public agencies. The law is very clear, and it says the public agency has up to 10 working days to first find the record and then determine if it is legally releasable. They don't have 10 days to sit on your request and then go tell you to pound sand. That's not how that works. But it's the game that they like to play. So these jokers over at Kern Community College District wait the full 10 days. You know, Christine is calling them and emailing them, hey, what about my records request? Finally, and this is all via email. They were communicating with us via email. We were communicating with them. That's all perfectly fine under the public records request. So instead, what they did was they typed up a letter and sent it snail mail on the very last day of the 10-day period. And what did that letter say? It said, you have not requested a record. You have requested information. And under the Public Records Act, we don't actually have to respond to this. I mean, it was just ludicrous.
So more stonewalling.
I mean, come on, Joe. You've dealt with it before.
Yeah.
It just, every time it happens, you just roll your eyes and think, are you guys getting a kick out of this? Or is this just the, you know, this is the way you operate with the public, and you just, it's just standard operating procedure at this point. It just is so frustrating, because here's the thing. You and I, Christine Bedell, and everybody that works in here, and everybody that works at Fresno Bee, and, you know, and the various other news stations, this is our job. We do this, you know, 40 hours a week, where we're knocking our heads again. We're not going to go anywhere. We're going to keep after this. And as soon as they pull these kind of stupid little games, of course, we're going to go after it even more. But what about Mr. Public? Mr. Public, who had that question, if they had gone to the Kern Community College District and gotten this response, which they would have just gone away and never gotten the answer. And that's not how public agencies should work. They actually belong to us. This is our money. We should get to ask the question and get the answer. Anyway, so what ended up happening was, you know, Christine Bedell got fed up, and she calls him up and she said, look, I got your letter, and this is going in the paper, and you guys are going to look like idiots. And so lo and behold, they scratch around and they come up with the lawsuit was voted on at a Kern Community College District meeting. And in the minutes of the meeting, it says how much they were going to spend. You know, they weren't going to spend more than $50,000. And so somebody, I think, gave Christine the minutes. And then she had also wanted to know, well, where is this money coming from? So they sent her a link to the entire budget. You know, like, go searching. You know, it's like, really? Come on. So what I ended up doing when I did the column was I sort of reiterated how ridiculous all of that was, and I called the president of the Board of Trustees to ask him, you know, is this how you think that the community college district should respond to a very simple question from a taxpayer? I mean, you're there to be fiduciarily responsible. You're a taxpayer. You're supposed to be making sure that our tax dollars are spent wisely and that taxpayers understand how they're being spent. Now you answer me, Mr. Board President, how does this all fit in that? And he kind of dodged the question, you know, with this sort of like, oh, I'm not an expert in the public records law, so I can't really answer that, but I'll check. I don't think they'll check, but I just wanted to spank them a little in public, and I did, and I'm glad I did because they annoyed me.
And what's the response been from the community since this whole revelation about the stonewalling over the cost of this lawsuit? It's kind of interesting that it would come to a lawsuit. There's many colleges throughout the country, whether they're NC2A or community colleges, that deal with these sorts of things. It's relatively rare to see something go this far. And what's the response been overall from the community with this latest revelation?
Well, most people that want to talk about it will say they think it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that we're doing this lawsuit. It's just more good money after bad, and it is ridiculous that they probably wouldn't even have noticed, except that the college district did this silly little stonewalling thing, and then we wrote about how they were being so ridiculous. And so people have responded that, you know, this is just it's just classic government garbage, and they're sick of it. I mean, people really are sick of this kind of stuff from the government, and so the problem is that there's an underlying segment of the community that is very supportive of the Helmet Club and very supportive of BC football, and they kind of can't see beyond their nose. You know what I'm saying? They think, you know, look, we're just supporting these kids, and we want to make them have a good experience, and we want to help support the college. And I understand that, and I agree with that, but they can't see beyond the fact that, look, you broke the rules, and the rules are there for reasons, and you know, now you got to pay the price. So those people have remained publicly very silent. I'm sure that they're, you know, very vocal with, you know, the Board of Trustees on a sort of a QT level, but they're not writing into the paper. Although they did at first when this whole first thing broke, a lot of people wrote in and said, oh, these are ticky-tacky rules, and we're just being made an example of, and it's completely unfair. But you don't hear so much about them from anybody publicly anymore now that we're talking, you know, essentially pretty big money. I mean, $50,000 to go to court over something that we've already lost three times is pretty ridiculous.
Well, again, Lois Henry from the Bakersfield, California, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for following up on this story with a great determination and doggedness in getting government transparency where it's needed and required. Lois,
well,
thanks,
you know,
a lot.
I graduated from Fresno State, and we are the Bulldogs.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Lois Henry, Bakersfield, California, thanks again.
All right. Thanks, Joe. Talk to you later.
You're listening to Valley Edition. During the Mexican holiday of Dia de los Muertos, people remember their loved ones who have died. Traditionally, they honor the deceased with altars featuring sugar skulls, marigold flowers, photos, and their favorite foods and drinks. This month, Arte Americas in downtown Fresno is exhibiting holiday altars in memory of local residents and Latino icons. FM 89 reporter Rebecca Plevin met one of the people who installed an altar and sent us this audio postcard.
My name is Helen Rayel, and I've been involved with Arte Americas for over 20 years, and one of the installers of Dia de los Muertos exhibit. And it's called Contigo en la Distancia, with you at a distance, or better well said, with you always. Dia de los Muertos is a sacred holiday in Mexico, and it is not Halloween, and we don't want to confuse the public that it's about trick-or-treat. It's not. It's a sacred holiday that kind of blends with Memorial Day and Valentine's Day. In America, we memorialize our dead during Memorial Day. In Mexico, they do it during Day of the Dead, and they give a sugar skull. In America, we give a heart. And both are parts of our body. And so we memorialize them. We put pictures of them in a home altar. Also their favorite drink or their favorite pastime, whether it's playing cards or building rockets or whatever. We have their favorite things on their altars along with pictures that will tell their story. When you walk up to this, you will see the installation, and it's a yellow and lavender, which is kind of the colors of Day of the Dead. I've selected a writer, an architect, and a painter. Pedro Ramirez Vázquez was a Mexican architect who designed the Anthropology Museum in Mexico. Carlos Fuentes was a Mexican writer and a novelist and essayist. One of his books was made into an American movie, El Gringo. And we have Ignacio Barrios, who is a Mexican painter, mostly watercolor and painted landscapes. Contigo en la distancia. If you look at Pedro Ramirez Vázquez, you will see the compass has become a skeleton form over here. And the butterfly is there, the monarch butterfly, which has taken them on to the afterlife. And then here you have Carlos Fuentes' books, and you have Ignacio Barros' brushes that are also have skeleton figures on them. And all through here you have a shot glass, which is tequila. And so we're offering them a good shot on their way out. And the monarch butterfly follows everyone to its to the thereafter. What I thought was important is that when students come through here, that they can say, well, this is a writer, this is a painter, this is an architect, this was a crossover singer, this was a songwriter, a film actress. We can too. Si se puede. We can do those things as well. And that's what we'd like for students to take away from here. They can leave a footprint. They can leave a huella because we are showing them the way. Even if it is through Day of the Dead, it's about living. It's about bringing back to life these people. And being that we're going to be dead a long time, if we don't remember those who have gone before us, they die. So it's not a morbid holiday. It's a celebration of their lives.
That was music by the Cuban musician Cesar Portillo de la Luz, his song Contigo en la Distancia. He died this year and is among those honored in Helen Rayl's altar, and that song also gave the exhibit its name. Joining us now in our studio, we have Arte America's Executive Director, Frank Delgado. Welcome, Frank.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
You have a lot of things coming up this year to celebrate Dia de los Muertos. The exhibit that we just heard a brief sample of, those are only a few of the folks featured with their altars at the museum. It's ongoing right now, so people can check that out, correct?
Correct. And the actual Dia de los Muertos day is November the 2nd. And what we actually do is we keep the exhibit up for an additional week because so many people see it for the first time on Day of the Dead. And there are a collection of installations, altars, photography, all of it based around Day of the Dead and around the 100th anniversary, commemorating the 100th anniversary of the death of Jose Guadalupe Posada, whose iconography has now become synonymous with Day of the Dead.
And this is all taking place at Arte Americas in downtown Fresno, and that's just the centerpiece of this big event because you have a number of other things going on, both in your plaza and also a procession down the Fulton Mall. Tell us about what else is coming up.
Well, last year we sort of set the stage. We had about 1,200 people who joined us, and we have a big procession that starts at the clock tower in the Fulton Mall. This year, since Day of the Dead falls on a Saturday, it's perfect. We can start earlier, free art activities. There's going to be samba drumming, samba workshops, and then people get to all light candles, LEDs, and other sorts of light-up things, and everybody's face-painted, and they come to the Arte Americas Plaza. It's about six blocks away. We have a trolley taking people, shuttling people from Arte Americas, which is at Calaveras and Van Ness in downtown Fresno, to the Fulton Mall so they can park there with us, take part in the procession, get their faces painted, and then come back, and it's a big party until 10 p.m.
You've got live music and other things going on. It's going to be a lot of fun. I thought the way that Helen described the event, and not this the event, the day, Dia de los Muertos, as being a cross between Memorial Day and Valentine's Day, it was really powerful and really enlightening. Talk a little more about what you think it means for the community.
Well, it's become, in terms of pop culture, just so much more accessible. I mean, you can buy Dia de los Muertos t-shirts at Target anymore. But what gives us the opportunity as the Latino Cultural Center in Fresno is we bring people in who are already familiar. We have this exhibit that is very true to the spirit of it. The artists are there, and lots of people who can talk to them about it, and they get to also experience it in this way where they can bring the kids, and they really get a true sense of what the day is about. And it is amazing because you see people as they come through the second, third year, their favorite line is, Dia de los Muertos is not Halloween. So that's always the big lesson in the end. And that even though in proximity on the calendar, they're there close, but they're not really in any way related.
Yeah, it's really also interesting the way Helen was talking about the students who come to the center and see the altars, and the ones that she's put together are notable artists and musicians and writers and things like that. And she said that it's so important for them not only to keep their memories alive, but to have that role model that, you know what, I can do that as well. That has to be powerful because I know you have a lot of students that come through every year.
Exactly. And it also makes them, puts them in contact because we have other altars that are just to people's family members. And it also really sort of elevates their idea of how important it is to remember those that have passed, because they are just like the Bebo Valdezes and Chavela Vargases of the world. And having their own altar, giving people the ideas how they can sort of create their own and remember these people that they maybe have not thought about, it creates just a different connection. And they get to do it through art. We're open 5 days a week. It's free, completely family friendly. And we're really loving being able to share this tradition with the greater Central Valley.
Frank Delgado is our guest today from Arte Americas. The Dia de los Muertos exhibit is open now at the Art Center in downtown Fresno. And then the events for the day, Dia de los Muertos, take place next Saturday, November 2nd, on the Fulton Mall, the procession from the mall to Arte Americas at 4 o'clock, or at least it starts around 4 o'clock, as people start to gather and have the exhibits there.
And procession will be at around 6:30, so okay. From 4 to 6:30, just all kinds of good activities.
And then in the plaza next to the center,
about 6:45, yeah, from there till 10, music and face painting, food, and all kinds of vendors who create Dia de los Muertos stuff. They're local artists, so they'll be out there. It's going to be a good time, and it's only $1. So there you go. The dollar goes to helps us count how many people are there, and it also goes to, we're going to be constructing a new stage out there. So everybody put chips in $1 and has a good time.
Sounds like a great event. We're looking forward to it. Frank Delgado from Arte Americas in Fresno, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.
We'll be right back in just a moment with an icon of the music world. Country legend, Country Hall of Famer Vince Gill joins us to talk about his new CD. It's called Bakersfield, and his upcoming tour to the San Joaquin Valley that's coming up straight ahead here on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
I know that you've been fooling around on me right from the start. So I'll take back my ring and I'll take back
listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. From the honky-tonks of Oildale to concert halls around the world, the hard-driving, guitar-driven country music that came out of Kern County, known as the Bakersfield Sound, has captured millions of fans. Superstars like the late Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, not to mention hundreds of other musicians, made Bakersfield, at least for a few decades, a true rival of Nashville's famed Music Row. Now a new album by Vince Gill and pedal steel guitarist Paul Franklin seeks to honor that music. It's called simply Bakersfield. Vince joins us now on the telephone. Vince, welcome to Valley Public Radio.
Thanks, Joe. How you doing, pal?
Doing great, and we're looking forward to your upcoming performances here in California's Central Valley. Vince and Paul are taking their show on the road. They'll be performing at the Rabobank Theater in Bakersfield this Friday night, then on Saturday up Highway 99 in Turlock at the Turlock Community Theater, and finally in Visalia at the historic Fox Theater on Friday, November 1st. Vince, it has to be exciting to do an album like this and then actually take your music on tour to the city that inspired it.
Well, you're correct. This is one of the most rewarding things I've ever done in my career. I think I've always written my own songs, and I've always tried to to emulate what guys like Buck and Merle did by being singer-songwriters, and to be able to take the great songs of theirs and put my stamp on it along with Paul's was arguably one of the greatest things I've ever gotten to try to do. I adored this music as a young boy. You know, when I was young, this was the music that was about as hot as it could get, you know, in our world, and so it was very much ingrained in me. And even all the years that I played and made records that never did anything like this, I was always borrowing from those guys and always, you know, using the influences that I had from them in just about everything I'd done. So it seemed only right that I should do some of their songs.
Absolutely, and it's a great record, and we'll listen to some more selections in just a moment. But, you know, people talk a lot about the Bakersfield sound today. Do you think it's almost hard today to appreciate how revolutionary this was back, say, you know, 1963 when Act Naturally came out, compared to what Nashville was doing at the time? It was such a different sound.
Yeah, I think that, you know, obviously in the last 50-plus years, I think that has made that music even more reverent and more traditional. But in its day, in comparison to what was going on here, it was much different. You know, it was much more high driving. It was much simpler. It was a little more roadhouse, a lot more beer jointy, and not as lush and cosmopolitan. And so in a sense, to me, it sounded like it was rocking more. They'd always had it very beer joint minded, very honky tonk minded. It was stripped down. It was a 4 or 5 piece band with one guy singing harmony and Don Rich, and you know, just simple. And but yet, because of its space, you know, that music left a lot of space, and that's I think what I liked about it was how raw it felt.
You mentioned Don Rich. You know, people, when they talk about the Bakersfield sound, of course, Buck and Merle, but there's so many other musicians that made all of that possible. And
yeah, buddy.
Don's Telecaster, boy, that's such a signature sound of the Bakersfield sound. Of course, he died all too young at age 33 in a motorcycle accident. What do you think of when you think of somebody like Don Rich?
Well, he was probably as big a mentor to me as Buck or Merle or Ralph Mooney or Tom Brumley or any of those guys, because he was not only the musician that he was, but he was the harmony singer too. And he was kind of the heart and soul. He was Buck's right arm, you know, right hand. And the two of them together were so seamless. It was like, you know, it was not unlike the Lubin Brothers or the Everly Brothers or that kind of thing. And I just adored Don Rich and learned to play Buckaroo as a kid. And you know, Buck played a lot of guitar, too. Buck was a much better guitar player than he ever gets credit for. He played a lot of the guitar stuff on those earliest records before Don became a part of Buck's sound.
Speaking of great combinations, your co-leader on this record is Paul Franklin. And while he's not a household name for a lot of casual music fans, he certainly is a musical titan of the pedal steel. Tell us a little about Paul and your relationship and how far that goes back.
Well, Paul and I have been friends for about 35 years, and we've played music together off and on all those years, you know, in the studios and things like that. And he was the one that played on my first hit record, When I Call Your Name. He played the steel guitar solo on that. I've always been probably the biggest fan of the steel guitar of anybody on earth, and always loved the sound of it. And just, once again, being around musicians like Paul has been my favorite thing. I've recorded with probably, I don't know, 600-700 artists over the years on their records and duets and things. And I just decided if I was going to make a duet record, I should make one with a musician. That's what I've always been. I was always a musician first, singer second, songwriter third. So I wanted to honor my history, too, as much as I wanted to play music with Paul. I just think he's brilliant.
And your version of Together Again on this new CD really is just that. It's a duet. It's an incredible piece. Let's go ahead and listen to that now.
Together again. All my gray skies are gone. You're back in my arms now. Right where.
tell me about recording this, and boy, Paul has a great solo on this one.
Yeah, I think if you go back to Buck's original record, you'd be hard-pressed to not find a more definitive, more compelling solo than Tom Brumley played on Together Again. And I think it's probably the most... probably the most famous steel guitar solo in history. And even when I bought a steel when I was about 18 or 19, tried to learn to play, the one solo I tried to learn to play was Together Again by Tom Brumley and Buck. And Paul, you know, obviously tried to have some semblance of what Tom had done. Neither one felt compelled to make a copy-minded record. We wanted this to be the way we play. And as much as we were influenced by all those guys, we still had to find a way to play like we did. To me, there's never been anything that compelling about a note-for-note record. I think that you should have your own creativity spin on things, and Paul certainly does, and he takes that steel guitar solo to the most beautiful place.
Tell us about selecting the material for this album. Merle's such a prolific songwriter. How did you go about trying to pare this down to 10 songs? That had to be a challenging task.
Well, I think more than anything, once again, as much as this became a singing record, the point was to pick songs that really suited the way I play the Telecaster and the way Paul played the steel guitar. Didn't want to do a song unless it couldn't have a great opportunity for a steel solo or a guitar solo. So that was kind of the prerequisite. There was a couple of songs that we felt like were deal breakers. Together Again would be one of them. That's one of the greatest songs ever, but yet we wanted to try to find some things that weren't just the biggest hits that both of them had. And in Buck's case, we found two songs I didn't even know, and I didn't think you could stump me with Buck trivia. And we found But I Do, a Tommy Collins song that Buck recorded early in his career, and also another song called He Don't Deserve You Anymore. And once again, songs I didn't know, but suited themselves very, very well to what Paul would play on them. Merle, there was one song that I knew I had to do, and that was I Can't Be Myself. It's always been probably my favorite Merle song, and had that one good prison song, so I think Branded Man, and then just a little edge with Fight Inside of Me, and what else did we do? The Bottle Let Me Down, the greatest drinking song ever written, and Holding Things Together. Holding Things Together and I Can't Be Myself are the two staple Merle songs that I've sung my whole life. Change the part of me I'm proud of. I can't be myself when I'm with you. Whatever bar I go into and somebody say, hey, we get up and sing one, about 100% of the time it would be one of those two songs. So some of the selections were kind of, like I said, they were deal breakers and songs that we both knew we wanted to do, and then some were trying to find a handful that weren't quite so popular and this and that, and showcase what Paul could do and hopefully I could do with a guitar. It's as much an instrumental record as a singing record. I think that's probably hard to explain to people because they put on the record and they hear me sing, and that's probably where they're really going to point their focus to for most people. I can't be myself. And A lot of the music type folks that really like the intricacies and all the moving parts, you know, they're gonna get that it's as much an instrumental record for Paul and I as it is a singing record.
And it's received a warm reception from all quarters, including Hagg himself. He wrote the liner notes to this. Tell me about sending it to him.
Yeah, that was Paul's idea. I was so grateful Paul thought of that. And, you know, I don't have enough words to describe how much I revere Merle Haggard. And that was, you know, talk about the litmus test of wanting to really pass. That was the one. I figured, you know, Paul and I both said, well, if he really likes it, then job well done. That's all that matters. And he really genuinely seemed to enjoy this record. I think because he knew we didn't, you know, like I said earlier, a sound-alike record, a note-for-note record, it doesn't serve much purpose. And so we kind of tried to put our own stamp on things, and I tried to play the intro to Fight Inside of Me similar to the way the record was, but I bent the strings in a totally different way, and I think I found a really neat new way to play that, you know. And you know exactly after three notes what song it is, but it's not played anything like the original. And same goes for Paul on just about everything he played on there.
Earlier this year, the Country Music Hall of Fame opened a new exhibit about the Bakersfield sound. It's so popular, they actually extended its run. A couple of years ago, President Obama honored Merle Haggard at the Kennedy Center, and you were there with Brad Paisley and performed Working Man Blues for Merle on the stage. And now this new album is out. Do you think that there's a more of a greater appreciation for the legacy of Buck and Merle and the Bakersfield sound beyond just here in California now, in Nashville and beyond? Because sometimes there was that tension between Nashville and those of us here in California. But do you think that's sort of, with perspective and years, becoming more appreciated now?
You know, I obviously was not here in the early 60s when all that transpired, but I've never felt that. I've never felt that from anybody here. I don't think there's anything but the most, I don't even know how to describe it. There's so much respect for Buck and Merle here that I can't fathom that anybody didn't think it was the greatest thing they'd ever heard when it came here, too, when they did it originally. I think they've always had that rock star status from Nashville especially. You know, and I don't know that I believe that rift really existed. You know, it might have from a business sense and things like that, but from musical people, no. I think they always, and the whole world knew how great they were. And, you know, at the same time, the whole world knew how great other people from here were. I hear the same thing about Austin and Nashville now. You know, Austin's a much cooler, and I go, you know. Musical people are just musical people, and I think Bakersfield wound up being a place that so many people migrated to during the Depression and the Dust Bowl that they took the honky-tonks with them, they took the music with them. The same thing happened here. People migrated here and made this a melting pot of musical people, and so I've never seen any honest kind of rift that you speak of. And to tell you the truth, when I was 6 years old, I didn't know where the hell any of it came from. I just liked it. Yeah. I didn't know where it was recorded. You know, I didn't know where Merle Haggard made his records as a kid. And I think most people wouldn't know when they listened to the radio if a record was made in California or Tennessee.
And that's the real test right there. If it sounds
right.
Good, it's good.
That's right.
Again, our guest today on Valley Edition has been Vince Gill. He and Paul Franklin are on tour right now supporting their new CD that's called Bakersfield. In fact, they're taking their music, the tribute to Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, on the road to the Valley this week. They're performing at the Rabobank Theater in Bakersfield this Friday night, then up Highway 99 in Turlock at the Turlock Community Theater on Saturday, and then finally in Visalia at the historic Fox Theater on Friday, November 1st. Vince Gill, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, partner. Look forward to coming to see everybody.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen,
production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, and reporter Rebecca Plevin. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.